Council, of course, why we give power, and Mao has given us legitimacy. Mao was the founding father of modern China, and he was a great national hero, they even said. But Mao has done so much damage to the Chinese population, you know, as we discovered. He was responsible for well over 17 million deaths of the Chinese under his rule in peacetime. So I hope that after people have read the book and know the facts, they will find it's totally unacceptable for Mao's portrait still to be on Tiananmen and for the Chinese leaders to still claim themselves to be Mao's heir. And this would be like, you know, the German leaders claiming themselves to be the heirs of Hitler, and the Hitler's portrait is still dominating the center of Berlin.
John, I know that you wrote a book on Japanese imperialism, and some of the reviewers of this book of Mao have suggested that you yourself have quite a journey in how you regard Mao, because you were, if not keen on Mao, you suggested that there were beneficial effects of Maoism. How have you changed your own perception during this book?
I don't recall ever saying that, but anyway. But I certainly have changed my views of what happened, what Mao did to China. From 25, 30 years ago, some of the stuff we now know about Mao, some of the stuff that Jung uncovered, I mean, you could not know. But, it's one time, I think, in the West, some people thought it was possible to think that China had made certain advanced economic advances, which we've discovered it simply was not true. I mean, under Mao, in fact, the Chinese, the standard of living of the people stagnated or fell back, and Mao put more money into military spending than any other ruler we've been able to find. In fact, when Mao's prime minister Zhou Enlai presented the budget to Stalin towards the end of the Korean War for the first five-year plan, Stalin's reaction was, you know, that's an unbelievable level of military spending. It was in the 60s, it was well into 60%. And Stalin said, you know, that was higher than Russia had even during the war against the Germans.
But if we just come back to that level of military spending for a moment, Jung, because you make a direct comparison between that spending and the number of people who starved during the famine, and you suggest that he was actually exporting food in order to pay for arms.
Yes, I didn't know this myself. When I was writing Wild Swans, I did know about the famine, the Great Famine in China between 1958 and 1961. 38 million people died of starvation. And when I was writing Wild Swans, I thought, like most people who knew about the famine, thought the famine was the result of economic mismanagement, and Mao was no good at economic. But then we discovered that this wasn't true. I mean, it was true that Mao was no good at economics, but this wasn't the reason for the famine. I mean, Mao actually knew this number of people would die, and he didn't care. He had incorporated this number of deaths into his policy, because he was exporting food. He knew the Chinese population was dependent on for survival to Russia and Eastern Europe to buy nuclear technology and equipment and the arms industry for his single-minded goal after he took power, which is to build China into a military superpower and for himself to dominate the world. And I was very shocked at the fact that, you know, Mao was exporting food and knowing these people were going to die. And he even said for all his projects to take off, half of China, they will have to die. Very shocked. And I was also very shocked at Mao's goal, which was to turn China into a military superpower and for himself to dominate the world. And all these very few people knew.
The other thing that I think comes over very clearly in your book is the psychological portrait you paint of Mao. because you're suggesting in the book that this is somebody who was innately a thug. This was somebody who utilised terror and perhaps got pleasure from utilising terror, who poisoned and tortured his rivals and indeed his family.
Well, we discovered that, you know, Mao had a perfect normal childhood, even a happy childhood. There was nothing in his childhood that suggested one day that he would become a monster. His mother adored him, his father was strict with him and occasionally struck him because his father wanted Mao to work hard. His father was a peasant, actually a rather affluent peasant, but Mao was lazy, he didn't want to work, so he got into trouble with his father. But I mean, none of this would explain, you know, Mao becoming a monster. But then there was this text which Mao wrote at the age of 24. A commentary on the little-known German philosopher called Poser. In this commentary, Mao basically spelled out his ethics, his ideas on morality. And basically he said that to hell with conscience, duty, morality, and even posterity, I don't care about any of this. I do what I want to do, and I automatically have the best moral code. And the world exists only for me, Mao said. Most amazingly, he carried out these views throughout his long life, until he died at the age of 82.
Interesting too, John, this, the way that this book has been put together, obviously it's contingent not just on Yuri's interviews extensively in America and China and elsewhere, but you had really exclusive access to some fascinating Russian archive material, which of course wasn't available during the Soviet era. How much did that inform the book about Mao's relationship with Russia in general and Stalin in particular?
Well, it helped enormously. And I mean, one of the things when I got to Russia, after communism fell, some of the Russian archives opened, not all of them. But we got into one archive very early on, which was the archive of the relationship between the Chinese Communist Party and the Communist International, which was the organization the Russians had set up to foment revolution around the world. And in this one file, which just went from 1920 to 1943, there were about 250,000 pages of documents. And through that, you could not only read the sort of day-to-day communications between the Chinese Communists and Stalin, but you could see how Stalin decided from the late 1920s to push Mao to become the head of the Chinese Communist Party, which is much earlier than people knew. And also, Mao's own version of the history was that he had got to the top rather against the wishes of Stalin, which is completely untrue. And the other thing is, you can see how before the Long March in 1934, when the Chinese moved from southeast China, the Chinese Communist from southeast China to northwest China, which is generally attributed in most histories to Mao in some way or other. In fact, Mao's colleagues couldn't stand him and wanted to leave him behind. And they'd actually sent cables to the Russians saying, you know, would you take them off our hands because he's, quote, ill. And you can now read these cables where the Russians say, you can't get rid of him like that. You've absolutely got to work with him. I mean, even when his colleagues actually threw him out completely, the Russians said, you know, no way. I mean, you've got to work with him. So you can read all that stuff now and you can smell that relationship. And of course, some of it is available from the Chinese side, but I'd say, you know, the feel and the day-to-day feel and the incredible relationship between Mao and Stalin from the late 1920s, you can get a much better feel of that.
And much later on, Jung, of course, we were all mesmerized at the time when he sought to forge a relationship with Richard Nixon. And from an American point of view, that seemed a great leap forward as well at the time.
Yes. Oh well, you see, because Mao, for his superpower dream, he needed to buy foreign technology and equipment. He first went for the Russians, of course. This is why he wanted the Korean War and played a major role in starting and prolonging the Korean War to get these things out of Stalin and then out of Stalin's successors. But then because he got into a rivalry with the Russian leaders for the leadership of the communist camp, he shot himself in the foot and he lost the opportunity to buy these things from Russia. So Mao then decided to kind of almost like calm the military secret out of America and out of the West. And it was mainly for this reason and for the other reason of putting himself up to the center of the world stage that he invited Nixon to China. And he achieved his one major role, which is he became the talk of this world, and he was the center of the attention for a while when Nixon came to China. In China suddenly became this very glamorous place, and Mao was very glamorous. You know, Andy Warhol painted Mao, and even the Chinese spittoon, which Mao was spitting into all the time, and the Chinese spittoon came into fashion. Actually, I went to a friend's place for dinner once, and to my astonishment, the salad bowl was a Chinese spittoon.
who's somewhat averse to personal hygiene, and yet I've had several wives, many mistresses, and it's very difficult to see him as a love subject, but...
Then Mao developed this tremendous affinity with Nixon. In his last year, he knew he was going to die. The person he most wanted to see was Nixon. He sent the Chinese plane all the way to America to fetch Nixon to China to say a private farewell. Nixon came in February 1976, and Mao died in September.
Can we just talk a little bit about his personal life? I mean, I mentioned the wives and whom he treated abominably, and the kind of harem that he had as part of what seems almost like a court with bodyguards and doctors and young women to pleasure him. But he had an extraordinarily opulent life for somebody who was supposed to be a hero figure.
Well, he was a womanizer, and Mao, he loved sex, and he had a lot of lust for women, but it was virtually no real warmth and affection. And Mao was married four times. He married his first wife when he was 14 years old. It was an arranged marriage, and she died within a year of the marriage. Mao's second wife, he always talks about as the love of his life. But in fact, as we discovered, he abandoned her and their three young sons, the youngest only 4 months old. And also he caused her death. The conflict story is in the book. But he could have saved her easily, but he didn't lift a finger. So she was executed by the nationalists, Mao's domestic foes in the 1930s, and she was executed in the 1930s. And Mao's third wife had many difficult and painful pregnancies. And all the children except one were after birth were given away or abandoned or died in infancy. And Mao was completely indifferent. She gave birth to a baby girl on the Long March in 1935. And immediately the girl was taken away and given to a family who had no milk, and the girl soon died. And she was carried on to the Long March. And a few weeks later, she was hit by a bomb and nearly died. In both cases, Mao was nearby. He was in the same town. But he didn't even go and visit her. He said he was too tired. And so not surprisingly, she had a mental breakdown and was in and out of insanity throughout her life. Mao's fourth wife was this notorious Madame Mao, who many people still blame for the Cultural Revolution, and they said that she was the evil woman who manipulated Mao and caused all this death and suffering in the Cultural Revolution. But in fact, she was Mao's instrument. And she said herself that I was Chairman Mao's dog. Chairman Mao asked me to fight. I did. Mao knew she was full of venom. Mao once said to a family member, Jiang Qing, her name, Jiang Qing is full of venom. She's like a scorpion. And Mao wiggled his little finger to show a scorpion. And so Mao used her and her venom, with her venom, to do the dirty work that other people wouldn't do in the Cultural Revolution. And Mao knew everybody hated her. So before his death, Mao was physically very weak, and he felt vulnerable. He was afraid of a coup. So he said to his military commanders, using a Chinese allusion, he said they were welcome to get his wife and her gang as long as they leave him to die in his bed. This was exactly what happened. You know, Mao died in his bed, and less than a month after he died, Madam Mao and the rest of the gang of four were arrested. And she later committed suicide in prison.
Let's look at the remainder of the political legacy. I mean, it's interesting, John, that the Chinese have just been very vociferously asking the Japanese to look into their souls, to look into their past, to confront the things they may have done, not least throughout the war. Is there any chance the Chinese will vote for a similar period of self-examination about the Mao era?
Well, I think lots of individual Chinese would love to know what happened under Mao, but I think the regime doesn't want to do that to itself, and it doesn't want ordinary Chinese to be able to find out what happened under Mao. I mean, in fact, it doesn't want ordinary Chinese to find out why the Communist Party is ruling China. I mean, there's no organization in the history of 20th century China that's more beholden to a foreign power than the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, it was set up by the foreign powers in Russia in the interest of Russian foreign policy and interest. And, you know, it has no claim. It's never held an election. It's never established any popular support for itself. I mean, in the takeover of China in the Civil War, there wasn't one single uprising in any town or village in the whole of China in support of the Communist Party. I mean, there wasn't anything like there was in Cuba or Vietnam. So they're not, I want to distinguish between the communist regime, which is interested in hanging on to monopoly of power and has no good argument for doing so, and what the Chinese people themselves would like to be able to do.
Interesting, isn't it, though, to compare what's happened in Russia and China in those intervening years, and when Russia tried to have a political revolution and then get the economy right. Contemporary China almost seems to have done part of that equation in reverse, which is to say they're in the midst of an economic revolution, which is motoring, but they don't seem, from what you say, to have done very much about changing the political structure.
No, I mean, you know, for many years, I hoped, I dreamed that with economic reforms and the revolution will come political liberalization and the political reform. But I must say, I mean, I feel quite very disappointed at the moment. And there is economic prosperity, relative economic prosperity for a lot of people. I mean, people's lives are much better, and I'm terribly excited and happy about this. And also there is a large degree of personal freedom, which the people couldn't dream of having even under Mao. But the political reform is not, I mean, in my view, is not going to come in the near future. You know, for example, and while Trump is still banned, and our Mao book is even more sort of tightly banned. So much so that, I don't know if you heard of this, and this magazine, Far Eastern Economic Review, which is an English language magazine, has been banned from entering China. This particular issue, because in the issue there was a review of our book, and the Economist, the Economist was not banned, but for its review, but its review was torn out. I mean, they went through that sort of the trouble to do it, and also to differentiate that subscribers of the Economist got the whole issue, but the copies of The Economist for sale in the hotel lobbies and the airports all had this the review of our book, which actually wasn't the link. To devote that kind of energy to prevent people, the Chinese, from even hearing about this.
Really, when you go to do interviews, I know you had difficulty because the authorities were saying to people, don't talk to this dangerous woman. So when you did talk to various people who gave you personal testimonies, how difficult was it for them to speak, and how difficult was it for you to elicit the kind of information you needed?
I think I even had to persuade them. I mean, the Wild Swans were banned, but I was allowed to go in and out of China with no problem. I mean, so far, I haven't tried since the publication of Mao. I hope so. I don't know. But then it was all right. And, you know, these people were warned. They were very old. They were Mao's generation. They were in the 1980s and 70s. And they've been to prison, denunciation, and orders, or whatnot. And they all, I feel that they just felt, what else can they do to me, to them. And they took us, then they made the decision to talk to me and to us. And in fact, we gave people copies of Wild Swans. For all my VCs, I gave them a copy of Wild Swans. So they know what kind of books we are writing. And I think after reading the book or having a look at the book, they decided that, you know, we are honest, we are trying to write an honest book, that is not a party line. Because these people knew Mao, and they don't like the party line about Mao. And so some people talked because they were warned, because they knew, you know, our book is not going to be party line, and it may even be fairly important enough for the government to bother to warn them. But of course, I think the government probably at the time didn't know what devastating materials are going to be in our book. I think they had no idea.
I want to open it up to the audience. I'm just going to ask you one last quick question, which is about when you were working for a lot of the time in Russia, making information on, you were all over the shop, including the issue of the Dalai Lama. You had a mass of material, you both got individual writers' voices. How difficult was it at the end of the research period to knit that collaboration together into something with which you were both
in? Look, if I may say, we actually did most of the foreign interviews together, the Dalai Lama, and also, you know, all these... John did the Russian material. John did the Russian, you know, because I'm Chinese, actually Chinese, so I dealt with the Chinese material. John speaks many languages, so he was landed with the rest of the world. And he did Russia. And we had this also, if I may tell you, we had also had a great fun doing our interviews. And one particular one, you know, the George Bush, the senior, Henry Kissinger, the MPs, and the Dalai Lama, as you say, and Imelda Marcos of the Shu fame, and Mobutu of Zaire, you know, the former tyrant. And I remember we were in Hong Kong after doing our research in China. John was in the bathroom, he was reading his morning paper, and he suddenly yelled, "Guess who's in this hotel?" I said, "Who?" He said, "Mobutu," because Mobutu had a very interesting relationship with Mao, but we didn't want to go to Zaire to interview him. So John said, "Shall we get somebody to introduce us?" And I said, John, I've done 2 months interviews. I'm exhausted. I can't be bothered. I'm going to the hair salon." To the hair salon. And 10 minutes later, who but Mobutu arrived. And he was sitting, you know, like very close to me, like where you are. And he was under this hair thing. And he had a bit of cotton wool around, a bit of towels around his neck. And he was a trap. So I paused in front of him when I had my hair rinsed, and I asked him for an interview. and he agreed. And that's how it happened.
I didn't realize what Cooper had, the woman who introduced him to the
window,
and I
had right. Which
was great fun. Was he getting his roots done? I need to know.
Probably. I mean, also had his hair treated. I mean, you know, there's a thing I could blue steam in his hair. The next morning, his doctor ran to take the action time. And the doctor said, oh, this morning is no good. The president is having a manicure and a pedicure. So I, you know, after our interview, I asked him how's the beauty salon. He showed me his fingers. And they're not bad. You know, his fingers, which were supposed to have strangled his opponents alive. And then we also found an interview in Imelda Marcos, because Mao was a womanizer. And when he met Imelda, he was almost blind. But his eyes sparkled, and he was very flirtatious with her. So much, and they kissed her on the hand, on the cheek, which were actually, you know, if anybody else did that at the time, which is the Cultural Revolution, they would get into serious trouble because of these were foreign gestures of gallantry or greeting. Anyway, and Mao's photographer was so taken aback. He didn't dare to take photographs, but the film camera was rolling and recording this moment of a rapt Mao kissing Imelda, which was an illustration in our book. So for one week, sorry,
but I want the audience to forget to speak questions, and I just want to let them participate.
I agree, right? Anyway, we spent 5 hours with Imelda Marcos, and she batted her eyelids and was very charming. And she said, I can see this book is the result of a perfect combination, the Eastern heart and the Western mind.
Now, this was actually the build-up to her parting remark, which was, perhaps when you two have finished your book on Mao Zedong, you might like to write about how a third world leader. But in the meantime, my confidence in her judgment has slightly declined, because over lunch she talked about how Western men never understood Eastern women. So I asked her if she'd ever met a Western man who really understood her, and she said only once. So I said, who was that? And she said, Richard Nixon.
She just gives a very dubious taste. Now, somebody just put their hand up here. Just with the microphone looping towards you.
Just wanted to ask, what's the acceptance? The way that you've indicted Mao in your book is extremely important, and it's important to prosecute the personality cult that he created. But one thing I wanted to ask was, let's say if Mao hadn't existed, given the sort of turbulence and the brutality of the times, would the communist regime that emerged not have been equally brutal even without Mao?
Well, the answer is no. I mean, Mao's colleagues were very hard men, but none of them was nearly as hard as Mao. I mean, because when the famine, you know, happened after nearly 40 million people died of starvation, nearly all Mao's colleagues wanted to stop, but Mao refused to stop. He wanted to carry on, and he actually said the death has benefits. They can fertilize the land. So, you know, peasants were not allowed to build tombs. They had to bury the corpses in the farmland and plant crops on top. I mean, Mao's colleagues, I mean, this is why his number two, who was a very hard man, the president of China, he balked at this prospect of more tens of millions of deaths. So he ambushed Mao and forced Mao to change policies at the beginning of 1962. And Mao was furious. He wanted revenge. And this was why he launched the Cultural Revolution, and which one major goal was his revenge against his number two and the Communist Party officials almost universally against his Putong policies. So China would not be nearly as bad as when he was in power.
What would have happened then, to just extend that gentleman's question, if Mao hadn't existed, what kind of China would we be looking at now?
Well, the Communist Party would never have come to power. And the thing is, when the Japanese invaded in the 1930s, nearly all communist leaders wanted to fight Japan, but Mao didn't. He saw Japanese invasion as a good chance to destroy Chiang Kai-shek, his domestic enemy. And he absolutely refused to fight Japan, and he said he welcomed the Japanese occupation. And if the Communist Party had really fought Japan, it would have been wiped out by the Japanese. And by preserving the Communist forces, refusing to fight Japan, Mao built up a Communist force that was able to have a contest with Chiang Kai-shek and eventually won China.
Well, this is an extension of that question. There's one mystery. I mean, your book is tremendously illuminating about what drove the extraordinary events that happened in China. But there's one mystery that remains for me anyway, which is Zhou Enlai and why he supported Mao in the way that he did at a crucial point when Mao depended on him. He could have got rid of him, or at least moderated the process, the terrible process that was going on. Why didn't he?
Well, this is another very exciting discoveries for us, which was the relationship between Mao and his Prime Minister Zhou Enlai, who wowed a lot of foreign statesmen. And we discovered that their relationship was built on blackmail initially, which took place in 1932. It's a rather complex story, but basically Mao, maybe I shouldn't go into it, it's quite complex. And Mao used this piece of fake to blackmail Zhou Enlai, and that was the basic relationship that lasted through decades. And then Zhou Enlai was discovered of having cancer of the bladder in 1972, shortly after Nixon's visit. And Mao, after having Zhou Enlai slavish service for decades, refused to allow Zhou Enlai medical treatment. And Mao wanted Zhou Enlai to die before him. And he succeeded. Zhou Enlai died in January 1976, and Mao died in September. So I haven't really answered the question, but this blackmail is a rather complex story.
Could I add one thing, which I think one of the qualities Mao had was that he was very, very good at manipulating the small group at the top of the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, Mao never stood for election. He never went out and made a speech in public saying, I'll build more schools or houses or anything like that. But he was an ace at the intrigue and the manipulation, which was very like Stalin's ability to control the Communist Party. But he also induced a fear around him. And he induced a feeling, I think, that people around him thought, if I cross Mao, he's going to come after me and he's going to get me. I mean, they all seem to have felt that. And so if they ever wanted to try and oppose him or something, maybe you had to choose a moment and you could do it maybe once up to a point. But Mao would, he would always work on making his colleagues to abase themselves. So one of the things in the book is in the year 1972, when Zhou Enlai was conducting the relations with, the diplomatic relations with America and Japan, etc., and as Jung said, wowing a lot of foreign statesmen, in between those meetings, he was having to go and sit in a room and write for about the 100th time, groveling self-denunciations, going right back to 1932 for Mao. I mean, Mao made him write over and over and over again. And so one of Mao's ways of controlling his colleagues was to get them to write self-criticisms and confessions and self-abasements, and that was actually a very important component of how he ruled. And spotting people's weaknesses, yes. He was very good at spotting able characters, and very, very good at spotting people's weaknesses, and completely ruthless at working on them. And there was a kind of servile attitude to Joe in Joe and Meyer's world at that.
I wonder if that explains life at the top, as it were, and how he manipulated the inner cabinet. Why was the population at large so supine?
Well, the population simply had no say. You know, China was a totalitarian society. In that sort of a society, there was no public opinion. And the people had had no right to say anything or to decide anything. Everything is decided by one man at the very top. You know, Mao in the circle, well, very top, it was about five people. Everything was decided among these five people, and ultimately decided by Mao. And through this small group, Mao was able to control the Communist Party, which is this totalitarian machine. And through this machine, Mao was able to control the whole population. And Mao was actually always unpopular, I mean, even among his colleagues. But because of the communist system, this totalitarian system, he was able to have his way. And of course, he used the terror in a big way. I mean, one thing Mao did in cowing the Chinese population, I think neither Hitler nor Stalin did, which was he made torture public. You know, when I was growing up in China in the Cultural Revolution, we all saw ghastly scenes of public torture. You know, the victims would be stood on the stage, on a platform. for example, their arms would be twisted to the back ferociously, and their heads would be ferociously pushed down, and they would be beaten up. And you know, my mother was a victim. I mean, she was made to kneel on broken glass. I mean, everybody in China saw these things, not just in the Cultural Revolution, but at the beginning of the communist rule as well. You know, when Hitler and Stalin mostly dragged their victims to some dungeons behind the steel gates. And Mao made everybody in China see those torture scenes. And that really struck fear into everybody's heart.
Could I just add one tiny, one of the most horrific things that we discovered was, I mean, in connection with that is, while the communists were coming to power during the Civil War period, in an area where Mao was in 1947, they were holding denunciation meetings, and the Communist Party actually issued an edict saying anybody who isn't sufficiently vigorous in denouncing the enemies will be stoned to death, which is, you know, one of the most horrible ways to die. But there was no, you couldn't withdraw. I mean, the terror was, as you said, both public, and also your family would be made to suffer if you tried to stand up to the regime. In fact, it was a kind of, you know, national hostage system, really. And many people would be strong enough to stand up for themselves, but, you know, when your family are going to be persecuted and beaten or stoned to death, it's another mass.
Gentlemen in the middle here.
You've mentioned that Mao came to power through, I suppose, international influence, the Russians and so on. But I wonder to what extent communism and so on is just a dressing up in the sense that Mao, like any other person who rose to power in Chinese history, was tyrannical, manipulative, devious and so on. And to that extent, Mao is really, in some senses, typical of what has gone on in preceding Chinese history, rather than a phenomenon of the 20th century.
Well, I must say, that is a bit unfair to Chinese history. I mean, there are a lot of tyrants in Chinese history, but there are also some benign emperors. And Mao, as we discovered, I quickly realized, has far less in common with the Chinese emperor than with 20th century totalitarian tyrants like Hitler and Stalin. Stalin was Mao's mentor. And Mao never modeled himself on any Chinese emperor. I mean, even the worst Chinese emperors were far better than Mao. And actually, you know, according to Confucian's theory, I mean, of course, there was a lot of terrible things about Confucianism. But Confucianism also dictates that the emperor must care for its population. And this is why Mao launched a campaign in the Cultural Revolution to denounce Confucius. Mao actually spelled out, he said Confucianism is people-centeredness. And because, I mean, the people have also, it's not exactly true. But Mao didn't like this Chinese tradition, which is an emperor must care for his subjects, which Mao doesn't care. And actually, by Chinese traditional standards, Mao would be just the worst possible tyrant. I mean, actually, if I was saying this to John the other day, we all know about the Great War in China. In fact, the Great War in China, in the Chinese culture, is not an object for admiration. The Great War is far, in the Chinese culture, has always been remembered as a sign of tyranny because of the number of people who died building the Great War. I mean, the most famous story linked to the Great War is this country woman whose husband was drafted to build the Great War and who died there. And she went across China to look for him, and when she arrived, she realized he had died. And so she cried, and her tears and cries brought the Great War down. So Mao is not a Chinese emperor. He was a Stalin.
Thanks very much. I'd like to ask a bit about the reaction you've had to the book. The flavor of a couple of questions you've already had suggests someone saying there would have been someone else other than Mao in that vein, someone else saying, isn't he in the Chinese tradition of tyranny? These sound like kind of apologia in a way, that the West, particularly the Western left, has got a great deal of coming to terms with Mao's monstrosity. Could you say a bit about the reaction you've had from Edward Heath, or more ludicrous figures like Tony Benn, who described Mao as the greatest man of the 20th century? Do you think there's a lot of coming to terms still to be done?
Well, I mean, to sort of try and give the whole picture, actually we came to the conclusion that the group of people did most support, so to speak, to rehabilitate Mao or make him seem like a reasonable world statesman, in fact, were Nixon and Kissinger. And, I mean, until then, there were some people on the left who thought Mao was a good thing. I mean, I would divide them into two different groups. There were the people who thought he was actually doing something good, and the people who had some idea of what he was actually doing and thought that was okay. And I think they're different. I would adopt a different attitude to those two sorts of people. But until Nixon went to China in 1972, Mao was really very isolated on the world stage. And Nixon, we discovered that Nixon, for his own reasons, in order to sell his visit to China, everything, he had to make Mao look good. He had to make Mao look reasonable. And in fact, he set up, at the time of the Watergate crisis, we were astonished, Nixon actually set up a unit in the White House to burnish Mao Zedong's image and to trash his old political allies on the American right who were trying to tell the truth about Mao. I mean, it's an extraordinary subplot, but it did work because, in fact, as Jung said, it was exactly when Nixon went to China that Andy Warhol did his Mao portrait, which is the sort of, if there's one kind of emblem of making Mao look benign or reasonable, that probably is it. So there are several, it's a complex but actually more interesting picture in a way, which we describe in detail in the book.
It's interesting that Ben Dawkins is such a lengthy pedigree, isn't it? Yes, on the edge of it. Yes, thank you.
I just wondered what you thought of future holds for China. For a couple of years ago, I was very conscious of the wall that the Chinese people still have for him, people making like lifelong pilgrimages to see his tomb and everything. And I wondered whether you thought there was like a mass of psychological upheaval that had to occur in order for China to move. I mean, whether you think it will move towards more sort of democratic political system.
Well, I feel, I mean, you know, the truth about Mao, actually anybody who lived under Mao doesn't want to live under Mao again, or a Maoist rule. But of course Mao is dead for 30 years now, and the young generation who didn't live under Mao and don't know, you know, what Mao's rule was like, they admire Mao. This was achieved by the regime through suppressing, you know, information, to suppressing the true stories. So I feel that all we need to do is to let the truth be known, and I think it would not cause, you know, psychological upheaval, you know, once the truth is known. But all the signs are, the regime is determined not to let the truth be known. And also, I feel very anxious that, some people may indeed want to be Mao's heir. I don't know whether you heard of this. It was just a few weeks ago, a Chinese general said to the FT that if China attacks Taiwan, and if America stands in China's way, China will drop atom bombs on American cities. And China is prepared for, you know, all the cities east of Xi'an, which is like two-thirds of China, to be wiped out. And he is talking like Mao. And Mao is constantly saying, you know, he wanted to have a nuclear confrontation with the West. And he said it's no more than a big pile of people dying. I mean, Mao was ready to do it at the cost of Chinese people. And his logic was the West would not be able to compete with China in body bags, in sacrificing its population. And some people in China today seem to be following this way of thinking, which is absolutely, you know, terrifying to me. And as China's economic power grows and its military power grows as well, you know, we all know, Chinese military spending is horrendous. And so I feel very worried. I mean, the chances are not another Mao will come on top, because, you know, after all, China now is linked to the world, and the doors have been opened. I mean, it can't be closed again. And somebody like, nobody will come up on top like Mao. But the fact is, we don't know. You see, the selection of leaders is entirely secretive. Somebody like this general, you know, if somebody remotely like this general comes out on top, and we're all going to be in trouble. So,
that's the scariest thing you said, Ollie.
I feel very depressed about it, and the fact that people dare to say this, and people could say this, and not being greeted with utter outrage and utter rejection. And the fact is that he was not greeted with universal rejection among the Chinese press. But I think the chances are that's not going to happen, because as I said, the door can't be closed again. You know, things like, I think our book will get into China one way or another, and many people will be able to read it.
Can I just ask one quick question after 20 minutes? But you're saying that if the truth were known, when the truth's known, people will begin to understand what's happened. People will, however belatedly, come to different conclusions about their history and about, hopefully, about their future. But all the people who were descended, as you are, from families who suffered hugely during all of these upheavals. They know the truth. They must have told their children the truth. China must be full of people who know the truth.
Well, you see, that is not necessarily true. I mean, lots of people don't tell their children about the truth because, you know, that's against the party line. I mean, first of all, they don't know the whole truth. They know, for example, people who know about the famine might think, as I did before, that famine was the result of incompetence rather than a deliberate decision. People who knew and hated the Cultural Revolution are still blaming Madame Mao. So it's far from certain that people know Mao's responsibility, even though they lived under it and didn't like it. And also, people don't tell the children these things. I have so many friends who simply don't tell the children because, I mean, you know, they want their children not to have these you know, blasphemous, so to speak, ideas. I mean, that would only jeopardize their own future. And so it's. You know,
that's
they're not telling their children.
We've got, I've been given a special dispensation for another 5 minutes, so let's try and get another few questions just from the audience.
Thank you. You describe Mao almost in the terms of Robespierre in the French Revolution. Chu Enlai said of the French Revolution, I think it was 1980 or something like that. We're still considering the impact. What do you think is the impact of Mao in about 200 years' time?
You've got 30 seconds, John.
Okay. If I'm around to know the answer, I'll tell you. And by the way, I don't. We tried to track down that Zhou Enlai quote. If anybody can ever track it down, let me know, because we never ever could track it to source. The one about the French Revolution.
Good line, though.
Good line. Somebody must have invented it, but we never could find it if it was him.
Yeah.
Does the same sort of free literature circulate in China as did with the Samizdat in Soviet Union?
Well, I mean, I don't know the full picture, so I can't compare. But I do know that, you know, for Wild Swans, for example, it's banned in mainland China. But there is a Chinese translation, Chinese edition published in Taiwan and Hong Kong, and many copies have gone into China. And there are two pirated editions. And for our Mao book, I think the control is going to be far tighter. And including control of the internet, or I must let you off the top. I mean, control of the internet, and so. But so that people are desperate to get it. You know, I have Chinese people who ask me all the time. You know, ask in the Chinese community. I think most Chinese people who you know read have heard about the book, but to get the picture, to get the book is another story. I just simply don't know how tight. Their culture would be.
Just quickly, I mean, nobody else has managed to police the internet that effectively.
As the Chinese regime.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I mean, unfortunately, the Chinese government's control of the internet now is much tighter than it was, I mean, even a few years ago. And the other depressing thing is that they are ahead of the game. But they're ahead of the game because of the technology that Western companies are selling them. And I was very depressed. I don't know if any of you saw this about a few weeks ago. Microsoft sold them this the top end of the state of the art control mechanism, which can not only block any website, but it can pick out any word in any website anywhere around the world. And one of the words that it picks out is the word democracy. And if a Chinese blogger types in the word democracy, a thing comes up on the screen and it says, do not use profane words. Find another word. And you know, so it unfortunately, I mean, the Chinese government has a huge internet police, but the technology that is enabling them to block access to the internet comes from the Western companies, which I find pretty depressing.
We have unfortunately run out of even our extended time. I hope you appreciated the fireworks to make you feel home.
Very good.
But if you'll be kind enough, ladies and gentlemen, just to sit.
still for another couple of minutes, because John and Ian will be going left to the signing tent. We'll be able to chat to you there, and indeed sign copies of Mao, the Unknown.